I'd like now to welcome to the program Jim Hartle. He's a cosmologist, he's a research professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and he's external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So how did you become a cosmologist?
It was a natural evolution based on the time that I started out in physics. I started out first in engineering, and then I went into physics. At first I started in elementary particle physics, but just as I was coming out, all sorts of discoveries were made in cosmology. The light from the Big Bang, quasars, pulsars. And so there was an opportunity there, and I took it.
What do you mean by the light from the Big Bang?
If you had one of these old-fashioned TV sets that when you tune to a blank channel, you got a lot of white wiggles, 1% of the electromagnetic signal you're picking up is from the beginning of the universe, 13.7 billion years ago. Of course, you don't know which squiggle is light from the Big Bang. And with a bigger, better microwave horn, you can detect that light. It's very cold, faint, but it's uniform all around us. So it can't really have a source other than the beginning, like a point source from a star or some other galaxy. And it fits what's called the light from a hot, featureless cavity to an excellent approximation. In short, identifying that radiation which we get with light from the time when the universe was very compressed and very hot and is now cooled fits.
We talk about the universe. What do we mean by the universe? Is it all that ever was and ever will be, or are there things before or outside our universe?
That's what I would mean by it, all that was ever was and ever will be. But now there's a sort of variation of the theory in which we could be living in a little pocket universe, you know, a much bigger one, and people sometimes call that the little pockets the universe. Whatever they are, the little pockets are not so little. They cover everything that we can see or will see or have seen. So there's a little ambiguity there. But in this conversation, I'll mean the whole thing.
So 13.7, maybe a little more than that, billion years ago, at the time of the Big Bang, what was the Big Bang? Was it, the way it sounds, an explosion of some kind?
The Big Bang is a moment in time. Right, not a place in space. So if you look at all the galaxies today, as Edwin Hubble showed in the 30s for the first time, they're all moving away with us with a speed that increases with the distance from us. If you extrapolate that motion backward in time, you find all the galaxies were on top of each other at a moment approximately 14 billion years ago. So the universe was in an infinitesimally small size and then expanded out from that moment. But it wasn't expansion into a void. Everything expanded at the same time.
And so what was there, say, a half an hour earlier?
As a practical matter, the Big Bang is the beginning, because it's as far, the light from the Big Bang is about as far back as we, that's as far back as we can see, not only in practice, but also in principle, and therefore people count it as the beginning. And there is a sense in which the notion of time breaks down at the Big Bang, because the fluctuations in space-time get large, and it just doesn't make any sense anymore to talk about order or what was before the beginning. So it's a question. The most modest thing to say is that physics has no answer for that, but it strongly suggests there's not even any meaning to it.
So if we want to think about it, is the beginning of time itself?
Yes, you could say beginning of classical time.
And the beginning of space also?
Space and time are connected in Einstein's theory, so in some sense it's the beginning of space, at any rate, the space with any size.
So, okay, we have this moment. Was it a very small moment from infinitesimally small to this expansion? I mean, days, seconds?
Pretty small. I mean, once again, the notion of time might break down. And the characteristic scale for that is 10 to the minus 33 seconds. 1 over 10 to the 33 zero. So it's a tiny, much smaller than any time we could measure on a clock today. Beneath that, you don't get any sort of precise notion. So the Big Bang was defined roughly to that time period.
And so what happened then? There was a moment where everything was hot and atoms and subatomic particles and stuff had not yet come into being. Is that true? Is that right?
Well, there were quantum fields. There probably was an epoch of inflation. Matter was created from processes, that is, particle matter was created by something like, you know, in a rough sense, analogous to the way they're made in particle accelerators, but spontaneously all over the universe, more or less the same in one place as in any other, that made a very hot soup of particles, photons, all in what physicists call equilibrium. Right? So the particles were annihilating, making photons, the photons were producing particles in a kind of balance. As the universe expands, just like any gas, it cools. So it got colder and colder, and eventually it got so cold that the light wasn't locked to the particles, wasn't in equilibrium with the particles, and could travel freely to it. A simpler way of saying it is the universe became transparent to light at that time. And so the light we see from the cosmic background radiation has been traveling us for those approximately 13 billion years. Since then the particles gradually combined to make nuclei. The nuclei made matter. There were little ripples, which we can see in the Big Bang. The ripples grew under gravitational attraction. They made galaxies. They made stars. And the stars made, an early generation of stars made heavy nuclei. Some of the nuclei were made in the Big Bang. So we're made from reprocessed stuff whose history can be traced with some confidence all the way back to that very beginning.
What were the first elements?
The first elements that were actually formed in the Big Bang are, to the first approximation, they were hydrogen and helium, right? That counts for almost 100%. The tiny little, like 1% of heavier things that were made, lithium, beryllium, deuterium, and so forth. Everything else, right, was made in stars. There just wasn't enough time before the universe became transparent to make the really heavy stuff.
And so, at what point were the laws of physics, electrical charge, the behavior of electrons, nuclear particles, their position, all these things, at what point was that determined? In other words, I assume these laws didn't pre-exist the Big Bang, but they've been constant really ever since. Is that right?
It depends on what kind of laws you mean, right? The basic laws, things that physicists like to think apply to everything, they, in this simple story that I've been telling you, they were operative in the Big Bang, and they described the very beginning. So the basic theory of the fundamental forces and so forth, electromagnetism, which you mentioned, nuclear forces, weak forces, and the gravitational force in the simplest models are assumed to be fixed. Later on, you get sort of specific models, laws like the laws of hydrodynamics that explain how waves break on the shore, right? That there were no waves then, no water, so they weren't operative. Those are called effective laws, right? That sort of follow in principle from the fundamental ones that I've just described. So they were there implicitly, but not operative because the stuff whose regularities they summarized weren't there.
Right, because the matter that those laws described didn't exist yet.
Yeah, that's right.
And so the motivation, so to speak, that's not the right word, but for these very light elements to combine into heavier elements, what actually happened? All this took place in stars?
Yeah.
How did stars form?
Well, stars formed quite naturally from a big swirling gas cloud in interstellar space. The cloud is not collapsing because of the same, it's sort of moving, right? It's like spinning to little regions, and it's hot. But every once in a while, a little piece of it becomes cooler than the rest, moving less quickly, rotating less quickly. So it doesn't have anything to hold itself up, like from gravity and it starts to collapse. As it collapses, it gets hotter. And as it gets hotter, eventually it reaches the temperature where it ignites thermonuclear reactions to burn that hydrogen and to make helium. Then it's got hot pressure, a source of hot pressure from that thermonuclear burning to stop the gravity from pulling together. A star like our sun is in essentially a balance between gravity pulling everything inward and thermonuclear burning of hydrogen to make helium. In approximately a billion or so years, the sun is going to run out of hydrogen. Not completely, but enough so it won't have enough to sustain this reaction. So what happens then is the star core of the star collapses again, and it gets hotter until it can start the thermonuclear reactions that burn helium, hydrogen a little bit, to make carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and heavier elements, and so forth. So, and the sun will become a red giant, by the way, and extinguish all life on Earth and archaeological records and so forth at that time. And then the process continues. Eventually you run out of that stuff, and another one, more burning produces more elements. That's okay, but the stuff is getting tighter and tighter bound, but eventually you get a supernova explosion, and that distributes all the stuff around the universe. Once the process starts again, this time with a cloud that contains carbon and so forth.
So carbon and oxygen and nitrogen are the elements that make life on Earth possible.
Mm-hmm.
And they are presumably distributed all over the universe, not just in our little galaxy and our
That's
little
right.
Earth. Yeah. So is it possible, likely, absolutely likely that there is life somewhere else in the universe like ours?
We don't have any evidence for life other than ours, but every scientist would believe that the chances were very good. That's because there's such a huge number of stars. There are 10 billion stars in the galaxy. Every 10 minutes, a new galaxy with 10 billion stars becomes, in principle, visible. So there's a huge number of stars. So it's difficult for people to believe that this particular planet, which doesn't seem to be particularly distinguished, could be the only place that life formed. So we don't have any evidence, but most scientists would say it's a very good bet. And if you asked them to bet on it, they would bet for it.
We're talking to cosmologist Jim Hartle. So, okay, we're talking about elements in the periodic table, like these original elements, helium and hydrogen and so on, and then the matter that made Earth. Now, there's also a whole lot of other things in this world, not on this Earth, well, maybe there are, but other things like antimatter, dark energy. What are they, and how do they interact with our more familiar matter, if they do?
Antimatter is like matter. You can produce it in particle accelerators, and if it finds matter, it annihilates with it to produce radiation, like photons. So it's plausible that in the early universe there was more antimatter than there is now, but slightly more what we call matter, and that all that stuff annihilated, using up the antimatter to leave matter behind.
Now, antimatter is matter but with the opposite electrical charge? Is that?
It has more or less all properties, all quantum numbers as they're called, opposite to the corresponding matter particle. So a positron, which is an anti-electron, would have positive charge, but the same mass and spin and so forth. So some properties change, like charge. And an anti-baryon or an anti-proton, same thing, as the opposite charge. Anti-neutron is the same charge, same mass, but it's made out of the kind of antimatter.
Now, so is there anti-carbon and anti-nickel and things like that?
In principle, you could make anti-carbon. It's much tougher to sort of make it in a laboratory, because you're trying to make a whole lot of antimatter all at once. But yes, sure.
All right, so what about these other things, dark matter and dark energy?
Dark matter is something different. So you were asking me before this conversation started about nothing. right? What if there were no particles or anything? It's still true that empty space has a kind of weight, if you like, or mass, or energy per unit volume, right? That is, there's good evidence, not completely compelling evidence for it today, and that's what people call dark energy. Dark matter, well, we don't know what it is yet, but we see, for example, we see it in the motion of objects in galaxies. For example, if you ask, how do we know the mass of the sun? It isn't by putting the sun on a scale and weighing it against something else, obviously. So we know it because we know Newton's law of gravity and how fast the Earth is moving around the sun at a certain distance from it. And that's why we can figure out the mass of the sun, because we know the more mass, the more attraction on the Earth, the less mass, the less attraction. It has to be just a certain mass to attract the Earth the way it's moving. If you look at stuff going around galaxies, right, you find that there has to be some more matter, not by just a small amount, by a factor of 10, that's pulling stuff in, right, gravitationally, but not lit up. That's called dark matter. It might be, for example, a simple explanation, it's some kind of particle that we haven't seen yet, but might be seen, for example, we hope, in the accelerator at CERN.
Very interesting. Tell us more about the accelerator at CERN, if it's possible to do so in language that the layman can understand. What's it all about?
Well, take this looking for dark matter, for example. From various arguments, which are too complicated to go in here, you can sort of guess the mass of the dark matter particle, if it was a particle. To make it, though, since we can't reach up and grab it from someplace, it requires a lot of energy to make it, just like it requires a lot of energy to make very heavy nuclei or something. So CERN is on the energy frontier of being able to make stuff. In fact, it was designed, I believe, to in part cover this scale. So far, nothing, but of course this has been all over the news, it's found other particles that are important for physics, like the Higgs boson.
Right.
But that's the idea, removing the energy frontier scale of what you can make by the energy which you can accelerate those particles, those protons and antiprotons in CERN.
These things are, I guess you would say, sort of fertile matter for science fiction and for the imagination and for metaphor. Do you read science fiction of that kind?
I used to, but I haven't really read very much of it lately. I like certain authors.
Does it drive you crazy as a scientist when people get it wrong in sci-fi?
Well, they have to get it wrong for the plot line, right? So, no, it doesn't drive me crazy at all. Warp drive, for example, nobody knows how to build something that would move you faster than the speed of light. But lots of plot lines call for something to be, some sort of fantasy. So you have fantasy and science also, and who knows? Maybe somebody will discover a way of doing it.
Right. Does the universe have outer boundaries? I mean, we talk about the expansion of the universe, and it's hard to understand how something that doesn't have boundaries can be expanding.
Well, for that, one idea that works well is to think about raisin bread. Suppose you were in an infinite sea of raisin bread that kept on going forever and ever, and you're sitting on one of the raisins, right? And as the bread is heated, the dough is heated, you'll see it expand. That is, the nearby raisins will get further and further away from you. And if you're sitting on another raisin, you will be getting further and further away from that. So you can have expansion without a boundary. If the raisin bread goes on and on, forget. Or think about the surface of a balloon, one dimension down, paint spots on it. There's no boundary. You can go all the way around the balloon. But if you blow it up, the spots get further and further apart from each other, and that's expansion without a boundary. Now, does the universe have a boundary? That's a sort of tricky question from current speculative. The simple picture, if we think about one universe, it goes on for forever. But it could be that there's an edge out there someplace, but we just haven't seen it. People are looking for such an edge right now, but so far, no conclusive evidence.
The kind of scales that you're talking about and that are your daily work, I mean, the size of the universe or the scale of subatomic particles, time scales like 13 billion years, these vast distances, they're hard for ordinary people to grasp. It's hard for us to even grasp 7 billion people on the Earth, mm-hmm. much less the kind of distances. What is the process of training like for you to be able to think in these scales?
I suppose we're this selected to be the people that didn't find any difficulty thinking on very large scales. Right? It occurs just very naturally in physics. And maybe the point to stress is that the universe becomes simpler on those scales, easier to study than it is here on Earth.
Why
things
is
are quite
that?
Complicated with the. That's just the way it's constructed. It could have been more complicated according to the laws of physics. We could have had quite a complex universe, but our particular one is very simple if you go to large scales. Here on Earth, we have all sorts of complexity on a particular fine-grained scale. Look at the books in this library, the 7 billion people, each with personalities, wants, desires, and so forth. But if you move out, the next picture you get of the Earth is a planet with a few little oceans, continents. You don't see all that complicated human stuff. If you move outside the solar system, it's just a little blue dot moving around. As you go out further outside, you get to the galaxy, you don't even notice the planets. There are just stars in the galaxy. And eventually, you get to a big enough scale, the galaxies are just little dots themselves. So things simplify because you don't have the detailed evidence to reveal whatever complexity there is on very small scales. And the laws of physics actually tell you something about what the universe is like on very large scales.
Planets, galaxies, stars that don't have the kind of complex life that we have here on Earth, is it that they are just simpler, or is it that we're not seeing them as close up?
Well, as I mentioned, people would bet, for example, there's probably life like ours somewhere in our own galaxy. One of the great advances in recent years is the discovery of planets around other stars. Up to a certain number of years ago, we had no evidence for any planets at all, although it seemed very natural that they would form from the same process I discussed earlier about the formation of the Sun. As the Sun condenses, it leaves a little dirt and debris outside going around. When that stuff condenses, it makes planets. So it's very natural to expect planets, and we find them. Current searches tend to be biased towards looking for very large planets, which are probably not habitable by us, but more recently people have found planets that are sort of maybe right at the habitable zone, as it's called. So it's very probable there's some sort of life there.
When people look for life or speculate that there's life, is it a reasonable assumption to think that a planet would have to be of a similar composition to ours and a similar size to ours to have life, or just to have our kind of life? Is it possible that there's entirely different kinds of life?
I think you have to say that the answer to that question is yes. I don't think we know enough to predict the process of the origin of life, right, is sufficiently complex that I don't think we know that it couldn't have been done in some other way with some slightly different chemistry. You can survey various people here at the Santa Fe Institute who are interested in that question, and you'll get some answer that it's fairly unique and others that it's not. But the simplest answer to say is we don't know for sure yet. So it could be. Yeah. But if you're looking for it, the simplest thing, since there's so many stars, so many galaxies, so many planets, is to look for the ones where we could live, right? Which is like the best chance, not as far as the universe is concerned, but the best chance given what we know. Because it works here, maybe it works over there. The same, similar sorts of places.
We're talking to cosmologist Jim Hartle. So do you cosmologist concern yourself with questions of consciousness, or is that just pretty much a terrestrial line of inquiry?
No, we don't concern, I mean, we are conscious, we hope, and not deluded, right? But that's a property of a very special system or set of systems. And the laws of physics or understanding, for example, suppose I told you, you know, how the stars in the galaxy were distributed according to a certain law. It looked like a pancake with a big bulge in the center. Would that tell you anything about consciousness? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. So we're just of no help for that, except to provide some arena in which consciousness might have developed. But that kind of complex phenomena is not usually the domain of cosmology. In principle, it's incorporated, of course, because it's the theory of everything. But the study of it, we leave the specialists in that area.
Right.
In general, science is broken up into that way. People, areas where you have a lot of data, then you get specialized sciences, like geology. That's the science of the Earth. And it's the science of one particular planet, right, out of many. Well, the reason you can do it in great detail is because we're on the Earth. We have a lot of data about it. We understand its history to a certain part. But you branch out, you can start to get the theory, planetary science, which is the theory of a whole lot of planets. What do they have in common? And so forth. We have less data about that. Then you get the theory of stars and planetary systems and how do they form. That's an even bigger area where there's even less data. And so on all the way up.
Now, is the theory of the Big Bang pretty much, and what you've told us today so far, pretty much accepted within the scientific community? Are there parts of it that are controversial? What are the areas that are being worked on today?
A Big Bang, a time when the universe in our past, when the universe was hot enough to dissociate nuclei, right? When the story I told you about the hot gas sort of cooling. Yes, right? I'd say there's consensus on that. People always try to test the idea to see whether, you know, you could get around without it and so forth. But the evidence is so overwhelming, I'd say most people working in this area have to accept it.
And what is the work that's being done currently? What are the unknown places?
Well, we mentioned, for example, dark energy. We mentioned dark matter. None of those forms of matter are like the matter in this table made out of protons and neutrons. So 97% of the mass in the universe is in dark energy or dark matter. Only a few percent is the stuff that we know well. So we have evidence for the dark energy, but we don't really understand it in some way that it fits. We just have to put it into the theory because you see it. We don't know yet dark matter is. So I'd say that's one very big question. What is the universe made of? We know how old it is, 13.7 billion years, but we don't know what it's made of in the big picture. Other questions are like, what's the quantum mechanical origin of the universe? How does quantum mechanics apply to the universe on the biggest scales? Every fundamental theory that we know here on Earth is quantum mechanical. Do you want to have a quantum mechanical picture of the whole universe? Just one thing? That's its own subject. So there are a lot of very big questions. What happened before the time we can see back? The history is pretty reasonably nailed down back to the time when nuclei formed, say. Before that, there's a lot of speculation, right? There's a lot of ambiguity in what actually did happen back then. What's the structure of the universe on very large scales? Much larger than what we can see. Were there other pocket universes? How did they affect what we see? Could they affect what we see? There are all sorts of very exciting things in cosmology today, driven by the increase in data that's happened over the last several decades.
What are the sources of that increased data?
Satellites, mostly. When you get up above the Earth's atmosphere, you can see, for example, I mentioned the light from the Big Bang that we see, and from which we understand much about the structure of the universe. It's detected here on Earth, but we're in the position of like living under an ocean, you know, and looking for the radiation that comes down through it. And there are only certain windows, right, where water, for example, doesn't absorb the that radiation, and you know the water is a little wiggly. We're down, so you get a much clearer, more unobstructed, more comprehensive view by going above the atmosphere, and that's what satellites enable you to do. There are important ground observations still being made, right? It's certainly true, and from balloons, but the real impact has come from satellites above the Earth's surface.
Are there practical applications of the work itself, and also are there practical applications of the tools that cosmologists and physicists have created in order to do this work? I mean, those are two different questions.
One never knows what the applications would be, but I think you have to sort of bet that if you, by understanding things on very large scales that aren't accessible to technology on the Earth, that they're not going to have much of an impact, you know, except in the general human area of trying to understand where we are in the universe and where we came from. I don't think, would you say that has a practical application? I think most people would answer no. It certainly doesn't have an economic one. So the tools are common to many other sciences, like large-scale computation, for example. You need that to predict the weather, and you need it to predict the structure of the universe. Not the same calculations, of course, but I don't think that doing the calculations has helped the computer science, but it's probably driven some of the computations that are done.
How is the story of our universe, the story that you've just told me, different from or in any way similar to all the other creation stories that we have on this Earth? Every culture has its creation stories.
You mean myths about the creation?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, the Navajo or something?
Right.
Like that. Well, they seem very different to me. And it's important that they're based in physical laws that we can determine on Earth. That is, it turns out that we can learn a lot about the physical laws that govern the universe from experiments carried out on the Earth. So there's like, I figure out what the laws are. Take the laws of electromagnetic radiation, light. Right. So those laws, when they're applied to the universe, aren't really any different from the laws that are applied to light or radio on the surface of the Earth. So the connection between our understanding of the beginning and something really concrete here on the Earth. It's not simply a made-up story. And most of those creation myths that I'm familiar with, and I'm not an expert in this subject, have a certain agency that's involved. We're trying to map out the universe as it is and what happened to it, but there's no sort of agency that decided to do this or that.
How does it compare to things like Aristotle's unmoved mover, things like that?
Well, I guess I haven't read my Aristotle, so I don't know what Aristotle meant by the unmoved mover.
You have been doing this work all of your life. What are the most exciting things in your life in the field of cosmology that you've done and that you've witnessed?
The most exciting thing that I've witnessed, right, is the huge advance in the observational understanding of what the universe is. When I started out, people didn't know the age, right? They get various answers. Right? There's a whole lot of conflict in the data. And gradually, that's all been refined over the course of this period. And we now, the confidence that we have, as I mentioned, going a good ways back, right, is really fairly high. And some theories that people have put forward, like the steady state theory, just going by the wayside because they're inconsistent with the data as we understand it today. So I'd say that's the most exciting thing. It's become much more of a data-driven science, is the cliche in the field, than it ever was when I started out.
When you started out, was it more, well, what was it when you started out?
Well, people had some data, of course. For example, they understood that the universe was expanding. They had these observations, but they were just in it, or distance scales. How far? How do you determine you should understand in cosmology, right, to determine the distance of something is a huge problem. Because we don't have a ruler that extends to the next galaxy. You have to, there's a series of steps by which you argue, right, what the distance is from observations of stars in the galaxies, and particularly variable stars. All that has to be calibrated, and starting with the meter kept just outside, a standard meter just kept outside Paris. It's an enormous investment of energy, and it was also, and is still, to a certain extent, an enormous, a significant source of uncertainty in distances. So, well, everything getting better and better at it, I'd say that's what we're seeing.
And does this work bring you, for lack of a better word, joy and happiness?
Yes, it does.
Can you describe
that?
Only,
it's not the only thing that brings me joy and happiness in my life, though. It's great to be participating in such a great enterprise. It's great to be making contributions to it, which I hope are important. It's great to be alive at a time when such understanding is possible and was supported by the U.S. public, right? And a lot could be done. So, yes, it brings me satisfaction.
Jim Hartle is a cosmologist, a research professor at the University of California in Santa Barbara, and external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.